Yeah, well, let's dig in. Hello, everybody. I'm David Cooks, and I tell you what. Today, I get to speak with Damian Bookman from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, my hometown. You can do anything you put your mind to. A one in a billion survivor of childhood cancer. He calls himself a bionic unicorn. What seems impossible
can be done by you. Your control of positivity and how that's going to play out in your life. You're in control of your passion, and everyone's it's like a magnet. If you're passionate about something, they want to be a part of it. And you're in control of your perseverance. Got so much to give, a lot of life to live. You must
go from paralysis to purpose. Well, I got my pen here. Yeah. I'm taking notes. Paralysis to purpose. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Paralysis to Purpose, the podcast. I'm your host, David Cooks. And yes, once again, I am delighted to be able to talk to one of the most incredible people in the world. I get to do this all the time, and it doesn't get old. And I hope it never gets old. Today, I get to speak with Damian Bookman. And you know, the best thing about him, well, there's a lot of good things about him. He's from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, my hometown, and he's doing a lot of great work. He is a one in a billion survivor of childhood cancer. He's going to share a little bit about that, that left him with an ambulatory disability at age 13. He's a survivor. He's an entrepreneur. He's a thought leader, a bionic unicorn.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. I don't know what that means, but that's what he is. And we'll talk about that. And he's an ability and opportunity leader. He's going to talk about his vision, not just for Milwaukee, but for the world at large and some of the things that he's been doing. So I'm here to interview him. So let me just stop talking and say, welcome, Damian. And we're excited to have you on Paralysis to Purpose, the podcast.
Well, Coach Cooks, thank you so much for having me on and that, you know, incredible and insightful introduction. Never heard so many nice things said about me, but it's appreciated. I see you as one of my top valued mentors, so it's an honor to be here.
Well, good. Let's say before we get into the Ability Center and your passion and your vision and all of that, why don't we just go back and share a little bit of your story with our audience, because it is truly one in a billion. And I remember the first time I met you and I told you, I was like, wow, you are inspiring to me. And you're like, whatever, man. Yeah. But share your story, because I think it's worth listening to.
Well, I appreciate that. 3 days before my 13th birthday, I got diagnosed with bone cancer, childhood bone cancer in my right leg. And after 11 months of treatment and 7 months of remission, turns out I got re-diagnosed a month into my freshman year of high school in my left leg. Now, this is after, you know, beach volleyball being my favorite sport. I was re-pursuing that. I had the high school volleyball coach telling me, it sounds like you could start, you know, in the back row and just play defense, which these days is called a libero, because I was able to keep up with one metal knee, one limb salvage. I was able to keep up with the high school players playing sand volleyball. So that was my goal. I actually walked into my freshman year planning to have another knee replacement in my right knee leg and having that revised. And then here's something crazy you may have never heard. I had to write in a speech class in freshman English about what we love or what we hate or what we fear. And I decided to write about what I love and what I fear. And what I loved was life, because I survived cancer. But what I feared was getting re-diagnosed. A week later, I was re-diagnosed. So that dream and that goal and that vision of joining the high school volleyball team in my sophomore year went out the window when I became a bilateral osteosarcoma survivor in June of 1993.
No, I had not heard that. So you actually wrote something in class.
Wrote and gave a speech. Love life because I survived. Feared getting re-diagnosed because it likely ends up in your lungs and you don't survive that kind of diagnosis. And so that was a fear at that time. You know, only being 7 months in remission. I wasn't even out of the woods yet. I was still getting monthly checkups and then re-diagnosed.
What did that feel like? It's easy to talk to you now after having gone through that, but that was a death sentence. I mean, it was supposed to be a death sentence.
Yes, sir.
What did that feel like psychologically, emotionally, What were you going through?
You know, so there is a true statement to the statement, ignorance is bliss, right? When I was diagnosed at 13 years old, again, 3 days before my 13th birthday, when the doctor came in and said, you have a tumor, my response at 12 was, what the hell's a tumor, right? No idea what he was talking about. My mom starts shedding tears. She might know what could be happening. I'm 12. I have no idea. Well, fast forward to that second diagnosis. I knew what I went through, but everything went in my brain and stuck there. It didn't go in one ear and out the other. You could die. You could lose your leg. You could have to have more chemotherapy. This may not work. All of that I didn't hear, but was stuck inside of my mind. So I heard all of that again. I could see where all of that was said to me in the hospital at Children's of Wisconsin. I could see it all. I replayed it in my head, those 7 months of remission. So when I got re-diagnosed, ignorance was no longer bliss. I spent 3 days in the hospital bed post-biopsy telling everybody, I'm fine, I don't have cancer, this is great, I'm okay. Everyone knew I wasn't. The doctors actually told my mom, I don't know what to do for him. This is an aggressive cancer. It has an equally aggressive protocol. And if it survived, you know, that protocol, there's nothing we can treat him with. My mom said, you know, and they actually said to her, like, take him home, let him die peacefully with his family, with his friends. And she refused. And she said, find something to treat my son. When they found that 3 days later, the answer was, this is going to kill him before the cancer does. If we give him this chemo, this protocol, this much, he's not going to make it. And that was almost the case. They actually had to cut my treatments two treatments short and said, your kidneys are shutting down. Your organs are shutting down. We can't give you any more chemo. And so that was scary, obviously. I wasn't sure what would happen on the other end.
Wow.
And I will say, again, psychologically, the nurses, the doctors, my mom were all smart enough to protect me from knowing what their original prognosis was. Nobody told me what the prognosis was. So I had hope to hold on to, and that was enough to get me through.
Wow. So the fact that that's an interesting statement there, that your parents protected you from the reality of what you were dealing with, which allowed for you to hold on the hope that you were going to come out on the other side.
Absolutely.
That's fantastic. That whole thing you just talked about is the mental paralysis that sometimes people face when they're dealing with very, very difficult situations and circumstances, and the odds are stacked against you, and you've got to figure out how to switch that. You said you heard things, or you didn't hear things, but say that again, because I want to come back to that.
So, you know, you're a teenager, right? You're just entering your teenage years. You're 13 years old. You know, all I understood and heard was you're going to have a year of chemotherapy. You're going to have surgery, which is called a limb salvage. Maybe we're going to have to amputate, maybe not. At 13 years old, I had to make a decision of, if we take you, you know, we put you under, we do this surgery, if we have to amputate, here's your two choices. You can either be a full amputee, or you can have half of the section cut out, and then we'll take your foot, rotate it 180 degrees and attach it to your thigh, and your ankle will then work as your knee joint would. So imagine that a teenager is thinking, sure, I would like to have a backward facing foot functionally. So that was the decision I made. If you had to amputate, that's what you're going to do. So you hear all these things, and I had to sign off on the chemotherapies I was getting, the surgery I chose at 13 years old. I was part of the decision, which is a big decision to make as a teenager. And, you know, all the negative stuff just, again, never exited my mind. It just, I never held on to it. I held on to positivity. Unknowingly, I learned later in life that it was because I wouldn't get more chemo until I felt mentally ready to get it. Is, I think, why I also, the first time around, I finished my treatment a month ahead of schedule. You know, I never was held back from getting chemotherapy because my counts were too low. But I can tell you, and I think that this is astounding, this is what positivity speaks to me on, and the power of it, is when I would go to get more chemotherapy, in my mind, I would be praying to God that my counts weren't ready to get more chemotherapy. I'd be like, please no, please no, please no, please no. I don't want more chemotherapy. Not right now, I'm not ready. And then my counts were always good. Always good, always ready. And so I would then look at my doctor and say, I'm not ready. My mind's not ready. I'm going to go home. I'm going to come back in 24 hours, and then I'll be admitted. I would spend those next 24 hours saying, got to get ready, Damien. This is what's going to happen to you. I didn't say this to anybody. This was all internal. You're going to get slammed. You're going to feel like a semi hit you. You're going to be sore all over. You're probably going to be throwing up. It's going to be hard, but you got to get through this. And I would go back 24 hours later and I would start my next round of chemotherapy.
That's amazing. At such a young age, and I get asked the question all the time because I was 15, as you know, when I had spinal aneurysm. And one of the things that I do say is I didn't know any better than to believe that it was going to be okay. I was 15 years old. I hadn't experienced enough of life to make me feel bitter or pessimistic about it. And so the fact that you were able to know mentally how to prepare yourself is amazing. There are three things that we kind of talk about on the podcast to go from paralysis to purpose is perspective, perseverance, and partnerships. And you just talked about perspective in a different way that I don't think I've ever heard before, and how that was very important to you in just getting through those moments and how you saw things. You didn't see things. You weren't allowed to see the things your parents saw, but you saw what you needed to see that kept you moving forward. That's crazy. That's really good.
You know, people talk about how, you know, your mind kind of blocks things out. And that's why I think it's so important to say it didn't clearly block it out. It held on to it, but I didn't hear it internally.
We'll come back to David's conversation with Damien Bookman, the bionic unicorn, in just a minute on Paralysis to Purpose, the podcast. David's award-winning book, Getting Undressed from Paralysis to Purpose, is now available as an audiobook, narrated by David himself. Here's an excerpt from Chapter 2, in which David recalls meeting his roommate at the rehabilitation center shortly after receiving his diagnosis.
We arrived at the rehabilitation center, and I was taken to my room, where I met my roommate, Tony Otters, quadriplegic, a little older than me, from Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. He was sitting up in his wheelchair, something I had yet to do. I hadn't even gotten out of bed. In fact, I hadn't even changed from my hospital gown into normal clothes. Tony had been injured in a diving accident a few months prior to my arrival at Sacred Heart. But his outlook on life was just what I needed. Despite his physical paralysis, Tony thought and talked differently than anyone I would have expected in his situation. He never complained, though no one would blame him if he did. He was optimistic about his future. He was enthusiastic about going home soon. He was doing whatever he could on his own, but for the things he couldn't do, he gladly accepted help instead of wallowing in negativity or stubbornness. But his dreams didn't stop there. He was planning on going to college and becoming a physician. Like Coach Hines, Tony inspired me to be upbeat, to work hard, to focus on my abilities, and not let paralysis beat me. Life didn't end just because we lost the use of some of our limbs. Because of Tony, and along with him, I refused to accept the narrative that my situation dictated my fate. Together on our wing at Sacred Heart, this white kid from a wealthy suburb of Milwaukee and a black kid from the projects of Milwaukee pushed each other toward our goals of getting better, finding victories in every moment, and learning how to be independent and productive. Tony inspired me. What were the odds that of all the patients at the hospital, Tony was situated next to me? I saw Tony, the medicine, the doctors, and the rehab center as just another expression of God's grace.
That was David Cooks narrating his book, Getting Undressed from Paralysis to Purpose. Get your copy of the audiobook today. Now, back to Dave's conversation with Damien Bookman.
Okay, so you get your surgery, you get your second one. Man, a lot of people would have just been like, whatever. You get out of high school, you keep moving. You've had some 20 plus knee replacements, all kind of surgeries.
26. I've kind of lost count. I think I'm up to 26.
26 knee replacements.
Yeah.
That in and of itself is a testimony of perseverance, but let's talk about some of the reasons you did that. I've heard you talk about you knew the risk of doing certain things, but you wanted to play with your kids and that type of stuff. Can you take us down that path a little bit?
Absolutely. I mean, so my greatest first love and my greatest first passion was volleyball, hands down. The capacity that I had with two limb salvaged legs, you know, when people talk about knee replacement, a limb salvage from cancer is completely different. Your whole joint comes out, all of it, your tendons, your ligaments, everything is gone. It's all gone. And now it's all metal. It's called a total hinge knee. And I refused to stop playing volleyball. So in my 20s, I was making a choice knowing that I was going to wear out these metal knees and that they weren't going to last as long doing the things I wasn't supposed to do on them and probably functionally shouldn't have been able to do with them. But I did. And so there was a time where I had my left pieces and parts replaced. I got back on the volleyball court within 3 weeks, which was ill-advised. And I wore the knee out within 18 months. These are supposed to last 5 to 10 years. So the manufacturer actually refused me my pieces and said, we're going to take his pieces. We're going to study them. We're going to try to figure out how you're wearing these out so fast. And so the next surgery I had, I saw the adaptations they made, the fixes and design they made in order to make the knee more stable. So I knew making this choice that this was going to cause more surgery, but that's okay. The therapy, the pain, the surgery was all worth the pleasure and the living life on the court.
So you were willing to pay the price to live.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, it was interesting to watch my surgeon over that decade say, I'm not sure how many times we can do this. You really need to slow down and stop. And probably by the fifth in my decade of my 20s, he just said, you just keep living. That was his space. He's like, okay, fine. You apparently you've got this. You just keep living. And here's the thing, you know, coach, I have about a half a dozen friends who all also had osteosarcoma in one leg. They lost their leg to infection. They're amputees from surgery, post-surgery infection, not from the cancer. I can take all of them and collectively they haven't had as many surgeries as I've had.
Wow. That's amazing.
Somehow God has spared my life. He has spared my legs. He has allowed all these surgeries to happen. He has rehealed the wound every time I've been opened up. I had one infection. I was able to heal it completely. It's astounding. I am a beyond blessed individual.
Okay. I don't even know where to go after that statement. That's amazing. Again, I keep saying it's amazing because this is really a unique individual who has overcome. I mean, he just said it to you. He should be limbless.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
You know, at this point. And go ahead.
I always joke. I should be, Lieutenant Dan from Forrest Gump. When I first watched that movie as a teenager, I was like, that's going to be me someday. I'm going to be Lieutenant Dan, and I'm going to have my Forrest Gump that says, Lieutenant Dan, you got legs.
And you're not, and you know what? I don't think you're ever going to get there. So your passion for volleyball stayed strong. You were an athlete. So none of that went away. So with your cancer and your cancer survival, the things that you were passionate about and were driven about, they didn't die with that.
Absolutely.
They lived on. So you had to find a different way now to still fulfill that passion for your athletic drive. It began with volleyball and that kind of stuff. But then let's talk about when things start to switch for you and you became a little bit more aware of adaptive sports, universal design, and when did that start to work out for you? Because people don't know it because we didn't talk about it, but I mean, you play wheelchair basketball and a bunch of other things, but when did that become a part of what you wanted to do?
So in my mid-20s as a counselor at a childhood cancer camp called Camp One Step, they took me as a counselor to be an adaptive skier, to mono ski, so that the kids who also had limb salvages could understand that it's okay to do this kind of adaptive skiing. You don't have to snowboard. You don't have to stand up. It's okay to sit down and ski. So that was really my first experience somewhere around 26 doing downhill skiing. And I think because I was so successful in such a short period of time that I really started getting feeling okay myself with sitting down and doing sports. because it's dynamic and you don't expect it to be as dynamic as it actually is. And especially when you're on your own and you're in your own full control, you know, on a mountain in a ski, that was pretty empowering. And so that was one, but
I want to go back and you can pick it up right there. I want to go back to the statement you said that you felt okay with yourself sitting mm-hmm. down. Mm-hmm. The self-awareness, that self awakening or whatever you want to call it. What is that all about? And what, because you seem to be, you know, pretty okay with yourself to me at, you know, getting all those surgeries and playing volleyball, but what was this?
You know what? Oftentimes in our life, it takes something or someone else to encourage us to pick everybody else up. And that's what it was. These kids at camp were getting invited to this. It's the Utah ski trip, they call it, to the National Ability Center in Park City, Utah. It was designed at that camp for the kids who had a disability from their treatment, right? Whatever disability, blindness, you know, balance issues from brain tumors, amputees, spinal cord injuries. You know, we had some kids who were paralyzed from their treatment. So there's a multitude of disabilities. So they would take those kids first to Utah every year. And what they found as they started inviting the kids with limb salvage to say, hey, why don't you come to the Utah ski trip this year? They kept saying no. Well, then when they went to the parents and said, hey, look, this is really safe. Your kid, we're going to put him in this equipment. They'll be fine. The parents were looking back at the counselors and the staff saying, it's not us. It's my kid. My kid doesn't think it's cool to sit down and ski. They want to be on a snowboard or they want to stand up and ski. They want to be like everybody else. So they thought, maybe if we bring a counselor that those campers can mirror and see be successful, then they'll be more comfortable, you know, skiing themselves. And indeed that worked. That worked to have somebody they mentor or looked up to and saw at camp as a counselor sitting in the ski. And so that encouraged me. It encouraged me to say, this is for the kids, right? This is an opportunity to motivate them, to inspire them, to move them. I mean, and obviously I had a tremendous time myself and got a lot out of it from a multitude of ways, both personally and of course in my heart and soul with the kids. So that was the first encouragement, you know, to really get me to step up and sit down, actually.
To step up and sit down. All right. So let's transition here. Yeah. Actually, this is a pretty good place, I think, for us to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk with Damian Bookman about the Ability Center and universal design and some of the things that he's doing here, not only to impact Milwaukee, but the world. We'll be right
back. And the Bionic Unicorn.
We'll talk about the Bionic Unicorn too. We'll be right back. We'll get back to my conversation with this week's guest in just a minute on Paralysis to Purpose, the podcast. This is David Cooks, and you know, I am not only inspired by my guests as we record these interviews, but also when I listen back to them a second and third time. And that's why I want to invite you to check out our past episodes of the podcast. You'll be encouraged and inspired all over again. Like this moment from episode 2 with Unstoppable Tracy, a 4-way amputee who's living an extraordinary life of purpose. Here, she recalls what her mother's response to naysayers, in this case, Tracy's kindergarten principal, taught her at age 5 about facing adversity. And it came in the form of a simple 2-word question.
I was born missing my arms and missing my legs above knees. And I remember the first day of school, and I'm face to face with the principal, and I'm so excited, and my mom is with me. And he looks at my mom and I, and his eyes are big as saucers, and he comes back with, I'm sorry, Tracy can't go to this school. My mom, she just looked at him with her kind eyes and her kind smile and her kindest voice, and she just said, oh, how come? And he just said, oh, well, you see, because Tracy doesn't have her hands, she probably can't tie her shoelaces. And because Tracy doesn't have her legs, she probably can't go to the washroom by herself. And there's 35-year-old kids. And so how is this one kindergarten teacher going to be able to support Tracy all alone without her hands and her legs? And so my mom, she replied, if it doesn't work out, no problem. Can you give me a week to find another school? So hearing that, the principal said, sure, We can try for the week, but on Friday, you got to try another school. So my mom and I, we walk around to the side of the school where all the five-year-old kindergarten kids are let in. And she dropped to her knees. And she says, Tracy, it's really important that you and everybody's included. Nobody left behind, including you. I'm 5 years old. I don't know that if I don't get outside for recess, I don't get to stay at that school. I break free from my mom's grip and I go to run and play. The principal was standing right there. He heard the whole thing. And now the principal's eyes are all welled up. Of course, now the principal doesn't want to send me away on Friday. Fast forward to recess time. And the principal runs outside to find me. Because if I'm outside, I get to stay at that school. I'm not there. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes go by. The recess bell goes off. I never made it outside. The principal is devastated. So he marched inside to find my teacher. And he asks her, he's like, how come Tracy wasn't outside? Couldn't she tie her shoelaces? And the teacher's all confused. Actually, Tracy was the first one to tie her shoelaces. What? With no hands? How come she wasn't outside? She said, oh, her little friend couldn't tie her shoelaces. So Tracy, pardon the pun, gave her a hand. It turns out none of the 30 other kids in my class could tie their shoelaces.
Wow.
Do you remember what my mom said? Nobody left behind. Yeah. So by the time I tied 30 shoelaces, of course I'd ran out of time. It took me the whole recess to tie everybody's shoelaces.
Wait a minute.
That's Unstoppable Tracy Schmidt from last season. If you'd like to hear the rest of that conversation, it's entitled Get Off the Couch. Now let's get back to my conversation with this week's guest, Damian Bookman.
Hey, welcome back to Paralysis to Purpose, the podcast. We're talking with Damian Bookman, and we want to just pick up on his vision and some of the work that he's doing. He touched on a couple of things about the post-treatment situation that people face. And a lot of times we don't think about survivors of cancer or aneurysms or whatever it is and what the residue that comes with that. And when I first met you, you were talking to me about this ability center. Yeah. And one of the things you said was that you were, if we could get people to be more healthy post their, whether it's cancer or whatever they're dealing with, that is one of the things that was driving you and as part of your mission. Share about the ability center, your mission, why you do what you do, and then we'll just kind of go from there.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, it's all important for us to have an opportunity to be fit, active, and healthy. And like I say, really to play at the end of the day, whatever that means, you know, maybe lifting weights is my play, right? Running around with my kids is my play. Getting on a treadmill is my play. Shooting buckets is my play. There's, you know, that can all be part of it. And so when I was doing my research about this, you know, first of all, I realized there was no place for people with disabilities to play. There was no place for them to be fit, active, and healthy. Now, you can argue a YMCA, a Gold's Gym, and Anytime Fitness, they're all accessible, right? You can get in the door. But my argument has been, once I get in the door, what's my opportunity in this space? And if my opportunity isn't equitable to the able-bodied person, why am I paying you to be a member here? And so my doctors would always tell me to be well and to get active and to be fit, but nobody told me how to do it. And still to this day, I'm almost a 28-year survivor, and they still can't tell me how or where or what. And so I decided, well, this is a problem, this model that we have for people with disabilities, where organization A brings equipment B to location C on date D and has this mentality of if they can make it, that's great. If they can't, we'll see you next week, next month, next year, whenever we do it again. But the able-bodied public can look at their watch and say, it's 2:30 on Saturday and I want to go whatever, right?
Right.
People with disabilities should be able to do the same thing. And then not only do the same thing, they should be able to do that with their friends and their family or their colleagues or their peers or their whoever together. And so, and me as a father, as I've transitioned, same thing. I want to play with my kids. I don't want to have to tell my kids daddy can't. So, and myself as a father, I need to be able to play with my kids, whether that's on the field, on the playground, on the court, you know, wherever. I don't want to be sidelined as a dad and say, sorry, we can't do that, boys, because daddy can't. And I shouldn't have to. And that's the environment that we want to create so that everybody can play together at any time they want to, wherever it is. And so when I founded the organization and I realized nothing was accessible, affordable, or available to provide programming to people with disabilities, we decided we're going to have to build our own facility. That's what I do. I go big. I dream big. I vision big. I plan big. And we execute.
So let's talk about that, because I know that the building has not come to fruition yet, but you've done a number of things that I think that are notable that we should talk about. Ramp Up Milwaukee. You've done a number of things to help make Milwaukee more accessible for everyone. So can you talk a little bit about what you do with wheelchair basketball? Let's talk about Bradford Beach. Arrow Park, and just expound on those things. And then can you talk a little bit about universal design, what that is, what that means, and how that it becomes truly inclusive in this day and age of being diverse and inclusive?
Absolutely. So again, you know, our mission is getting people to play together. And the idea of the need for adaptive equipment is extraordinarily expensive. I'm lucky enough to have $20,000 of equipment sitting in my garage so that I can keep playing with my kids. But not everybody has that luxury, and not every grant can be awarded. So we thought it's really easy to take something like ice skating and put ice skating sleds at that park so that people can ice skate of all abilities. So we have a park here in Milwaukee called Red Arrow Park with an open ice rink. And so we included ice skating sleds there so that people can check those out, again, anytime that they want to, whenever Red Arrow Park is open, and they can ice skate with their family. I think the most interesting thing is the first person who ever checked out an ice skating sled was a lady who said she's clumsy and she was afraid to ice skate. So they said, hey, well, we just got these new sleds, so why don't you get in one and then you can ice skate with your family? And she did. I think that's great. You don't have to always have a disability in order to use adaptive equipment. And then there's a park here locally called Veterans Park that checks out bikes for everybody. The only kind of bike they didn't add is if you had a lower extremity disability or impairment, they had nothing for you to pedal. So we thought, let's include hand cycles. And then I, as somebody who can't bike, could hand cycle while my wife checks out a regular bike and we could bike the lakefront, right? Well, then finally, Bradford Beach was an opportunity to really go big. And we did it purposely. And what we say, and I, you know, talk about all the time, is what's amazing about Bradford Beach isn't what it is, it's everything it's not. So what we built was a ramp that is not a switchback ramp, because that looks like it's for people with disabilities. It's a ramp, more of like a pathway that isn't wood, because to people in power chairs, you know, who don't have the stability, a wood ramp feels like a boardwalk, right? Or it feels like a rumble strip, I should say. So head is a little bobbly, a little like that is, so it's concrete, right? It's not the ADA compliance 5.5 feet wide. It's 8 feet wide so that chairs can run side by side. And finally, the path that takes you all the way to the water, we could have chose the 5 foot wide path, but we chose the 6.5 foot wide path. Again, so that people with disabilities or in chairs don't feel like they're in the way, so that the able-bodied public feels like they can use it at all times as well. This is about everybody accessing the beach, whether you're, you know, zero in a stroller or you're 80 in a chair or a walker or cane or scooter or whatever it is, you can get from the top of Lincoln Memorial Drive all the way to the water, either by yourself or, you know, with your friends.
It sounds a lot like what the curb cut actually became. When the curb cut was first put in, everyone thought it would be just for people with wheelchairs to use, because it was part of the ADA. Right. But you found that it was acceptable and used by everybody with strollers, bikes, everything else. And so you're forward thinking, and not only do you want to make it accessible, but you want to make it inviting for everyone.
Yeah,
How do you get that message across to people who may think this is, it costs too much? You have to rebuild everything. What's the profit or what's the gain? What's the upside of doing what you think of doing what you've done versus not doing that at all?
Well, you know, so first of all, we get people in the space of understanding that there's one demographic we all belong to, which we call TABS, which stands for temporarily able-bodied. So whether it is disease, which I experienced as a teenager, or it's an accident of some type, or it's simply the aging process, none of us can escape the need for greater access at some point in our future. And like you said earlier, if I enjoyed volleyball before cancer, psychologically, mentally, I'm still going to enjoy volleyball after cancer. If you enjoy the beach at 10 and love it, you're going to enjoy it at 80. And so we help people understand that everybody is going to use this space. You just talked about curb cuts as a great example. There are so many examples of design that have become universal that were started only for people with disabilities. And then we realized, well, this really works for everybody.
I want to go to the stigma.
Yep.
There's a stigma that you indirectly talked about.
I didn't want to sit down. I didn't sit down for 20 years.
Right. You didn't want to sit down for 20 years. I know it's interesting as I got older. There was a time when I was younger and I didn't mind you knowing I was in a wheelchair, but when it came to my brand and all that kind of stuff, I didn't need to have a picture with you seeing me in my wheelchair. It wasn't there. Obviously you've done a good job of getting people to become comfortable. And I think you call it a different pair of shoes.
Right. Yeah.
Can you talk about that and helping our listeners who may have friends or family that are stuck in that stigma of, well, I don't want to look like that, or I don't want to necessarily be lumped in with that group. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, we draw a correlation and let's be real. There are people who have come to me and with disabilities who are wheelchair users who don't like that, right? They don't think that that's a fair or good or otherwise description. And I guess I stay in a space of, well, why not? Because these are the things that make you mobile. Your chair, you have what you call and wheelchair users call a day chair, right?
Right.
This is my everyday chair or my everyday pair of shoes that I put on to go out into society. The chair is an independent device. It allows you to get out in the world. Now, if you go play a sport, I don't care what it is, of any kind, you put on a different chair or a different pair of shoes. No different than an able-bodied standing athlete puts on a pair of Jordans for basketball or a pair of football cleats for football, you know, or tennis shoes, court shoes, you know, for tennis. It's just a different pair of shoes. When we explain it to people, especially kids like that, they really understand it. So that's what we do. We put out an array of equipment. It's a wheelchair. It's a pair of athletic shoes. It's a ball. It's a bat. And I ask, what does all this stuff have in common? And the answer is it's all sports equipment. And then when you put the shoes on top of the chair and you say, what do these have in common? Usually kids are really good at this because they don't overthink it. And they often give the right answer, but then I take them back to, well, this chair is my Jordans. You know, I got fancy color for Jordans. I don't really need these to play, but this sport chair, those are my athletic shoes. And so that helps able-bodied people really get comfortable understanding that that's all this is just a different pair of shoes. It's another piece of sports equipment. And as you know, Coach, it's not called disabled basketball.
No,
wheelchair basketball. It's not disabled tennis. It's wheelchair tennis. It's not disabled football or softball. It's wheelchair softball, wheelchair tennis, right? It's wheelchair football. It's and everybody starts to get it that way.
What role can people who have disabilities, physical challenges, limb limitations, whatever you like to call it, what role can we play going forward in this conversation to make sure we have a voice at the table? I'm concerned that we don't have a critical mass out there large enough to keep the momentum going.
You're absolutely right. There is not a critical mass for sure of people with disabilities in high level places. That is, you know, when you ask what can they do? Well, I think what people need to understand is they can do anything. right? And that sounds like maybe a cheesy answer, but that's where it really starts. It starts with able-bodied people understanding that people with disabilities are highly capable. They're highly motivated individuals.
What's your final statement for the audience? If they never, ever listen to you ever again, what would you tell them?
You know, my motivation in life really is balanced on your own currencies that you have. And for me, those are the three P's that you're in control of. You're in control of positivity and how that's going to play out in your life. You're in control of your passion, and it's like a magnet. If you're passionate about something, they want to be a part of it. And you're in control of your perseverance. It's up to you. Stopping is what stops you. You can choose to quit or not quit. And all of those things are in your personal control. Those are, to me, those are my currencies that keep me going.
Wow. How, if people want to get a hold of you, whether it's to speak or to do one of your programs at their school, how do we get a hold of you?
Yeah, just Google Damien Bookman. Yeah, I think I'm the only one. You can search a lot of names on Facebook, and there's going to be a multitude of that name. It turns out I'm the only Damien Bookman, and that's IAN with an A, and Bookman is BUCH, man, not like the actual book. But right. If you Google that, you're going to find me.
All right. He's also on Instagram. He's on Twitter. He's on Facebook. He's on
all. Speaks on all those platforms.
Say that again.
Yeah, Damien B. Speaks on all of those platforms.
Damien B. Speaks. So if you're looking for a great speaker, someone to educate your students at your school, this is the guy, and make sure you get a hold of him. Damien, let me just thank you for being with me today. As always, it's a pleasure talking to you. I learned some new stuff again today, as I always do. And thanks for sharing your story with our audience. And until next time, this is David Cooks signing off on Paralysis to Purpose, the podcast, reminding you that your ability to endure is always greater than your willingness to endure.
You can do anything you put your mind to.
Thanks for tuning in to Paralysis to Purpose. Don't forget to follow us on social media at Paralysis to Purpose on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. To purchase his book, visit davidcookspeaks.com. Be sure to tune in next time for more inspiring conversations with David Cooks.
You know, I think for my family, it was awesome for them, but I think experiencing New York through their eyes really touched my heart.
Next time on Paralysis to Purpose.
Welcome to Jennifer Kumiyama.
You know, my stepmom is no longer with us, and that was really... She was so happy in New York. She absolutely loved it. And I'll never forget that time there with my family. And of course, singing with Adina on the Lion King stage.
Paralysis to Purpose.